There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Every week on The Bookshelf, we look at a work of fiction or non-fiction in a bit more depth.
The Bookshelf, what you should be reading.
This week, it's Sophie Hannah's How to Hold a Grudge that we'll be discussing with our guest in the studio, Alison K. Williams.
Hi there.
Hello. Alison is a guerrilla memoirist.
Like Che Guevara, not the ape.
Thank you for clarifying that. I realize written down it makes sense, but on air it sounds like something else. And you're an essay writer, you're a travel journalist, you've written for the New York Times, National Public Radio, and more. Is there anything else that you would like to mention that I have not mentioned?
I've just finished a young adult novel and I am in the query trenches.
Woo-hoo. I like that you use the word trenches.
Yes, it feels like a trench. I feel like I've dug myself into a hole from which I will never escape.
Well, I'm glad that you found
your way. No, you'll be going over the top.
Thank you for digging your way out to come and join us on the show today. Speaking of grudges, before we get started, listeners, which Shakespearean character, after his friend is stabbed in the back, delivers the line, "Cry havoc and let slip the dogs of war"? 4001, if you think you know the answer, please include your name as well so that we can say, yay, you got it right. The example I gave there may not even be a grudge as Sophie Hannah defines it. I am aware of that. A large part of the book that we are talking about is focused on redefining what we understand by the word grudge. So I think that's a good place for us to start. So can you explain, Alison, some of Sophie Hannah's reasoning in how to hold a grudge?
Well, I think she makes a really great point in that holding a grudge is not necessarily feeling crappy about a person for a long period of time. It's more this idea that you can forgive without forgetting. She says a really interesting thing where she says, so many people I asked look mildly alarmed and said, I'm not sure I have any. I don't think I hold grudges. Oh, okay, that's fine, I said. So let me ask you a different question. Is there anyone you feel differently about now because of something they once did? And at that point, almost everyone perked up and said, oh yes, my mother wore white to my wedding, or my stepmom bought the coat I wanted and then never wore it. And I think this concept she has where a grudge is when someone behaved in a way that led you to change your attitude towards them, and you have changed your attitude towards them basically permanently, that's a grudge. And I think that does imply like a negative connotation, but I absolutely agree with that characterization. It's someone has betrayed you in some matter, large or small, and that causes you to treat them with caution in the future.
It definitely made me think differently about what constitutes a grudge and kind of her different categories for them. I thought in some cases there were too many categories because she goes yes. through a lot of different types.
She really holds a lot of grudges. She talks about her grudge cabinet, and hers must take up an entire
room.
What
on earth is a grudge cabinet for anyone listening going, what is a grudge cabinet?
I'm still not completely clear on that. I think it's this idea that you keep in your head or your fancy imaginary handbag or your fancy imaginary
wooden cabinet.
Absolutely. Hers must be like a card catalog, like one of those old-fashioned library card catalogs.
With those shifting shelves.
Exactly.
Against each other.
Where you keep sort of a mental list of the number of people who have wronged you. And I think her idea is that you put your grudges in your grudge cabinet so that you can shut the door and let them be rather than constantly dwelling on them.
Yes, but you can go and visit them and you can regress. She has a complex grading system for these grudges. You have from one carat to 10 carat, is it? About how seriously you feel that this grudge should be held.
I mean,
it's a very complex system.
You could certainly subtitle this book Passive Aggression 101.
Absolutely. A lot of these grudges, you read the grudge and you just think all you had to do at the time is say, excuse me, I think you have treated me poorly. Can we revisit this? Grudge gone.
Yeah, or sorry, that's not acceptable, yeah. Or I'm not going to be doing that. And she does actually analyze her own behavior in that way. For example, there's a really interesting story in here. I think the one that struck me the most, because I've had a similar experience, is she talks about her brother's wife. And I got to say, as I read the beginning of this story, I started thinking to myself, I sure hope they're divorced, because if they're not, they're going to be after she reads this. But the brother's wife, whose name was Laura, had given Sophie, the author, a really lovely painting that Sophie really liked. And Laura was also a little bit neurotic about whether or not the painting was successfully displayed in Sophie's home. And Sophie had just moved and she was in the middle of several large projects, and she had every intention of putting this beautiful painting up in a prominent place in her lounge because she loved the painting and enjoyed looking at it. And she's only been moved into her new house for, I think, 3 or 4 days. She hasn't unpacked any boxes except the ones marked urgent, unpack right now. And her brother calls and says, we're coming over to see the house. Is the painting up? And Sophie says, well, no, it's not unpacked yet. I mean, I'm going to put it up. And the brother says, well, can you put it up? Because otherwise Laura is going to be really unhappy about it and she'll take it out on me. And, you know, I feel like the option here is, well, man up, brother, and, you know, exactly. Tell your wife that I'm sorry, this is not acceptable behavior.
You're talking to the wrong person.
And what Sophie ended up doing was she did say to her brother, you know, sorry, I'm not going to indulge that. But then she felt that little tickle that, you know, so many of us, especially women, sometimes feel, where she said, okay, well, I'll just open the one box. And if it's in that one box, then I'll go ahead and put it up. And it was in the box and she did put it up. And then she never felt okay about the painting again. And
but
she didn't like it anymore.
The bit that got me, because there are a few bits in this where I think where you read and you think, author, you're a strange character. So I completely was with her through this whole story because I thought that would be really irritating.
Yeah.
But then what she said is that her grudge is not so much for any of that, but the fact that her brother then said thank you. And she read into that thank you as he thought she'd done it for him. It was a really complex kind of psychological
expression.
Yeah. And so she said it was the thank you that created the grudge rather than the digging around, finding the picture and all this.
And I have to say, like, after years of yoga class, and believe me, it really did take years, I think my reaction in that situation now would be, if I have a minute, I'll try to find the painting. I'm really sorry you're in this unhappy relationship. And I'm really sorry that she is so insecure that she is unable to place a person who has just moved feelings and convenience above her own, like, oh my goodness, my work has to be right there, right then. You know, and I like to think that I would react differently in that circumstance, but it is a bit maddening to read it.
I'm currently wishing that I had Alison on hand to just, like, give the phone to in certain personal situations of mine over the years.
There's a subtext to this book that I found really interesting and that she doesn't really pull out. And it's the fact that it's your own kind of upbringing and issues and foibles that actually make you have the grudges that you have. Because there's one point, because I'd been reading this book getting slightly frustrated with the author.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And because she seemed so obsessed with this notion that people were trying to control things. There was one I mentioned to you about Uncle Vern. Do you remember that one, Alison?
The guy who parked outside the house?
Yeah.
And I think I disagree with you on this.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in more detail. But the fact was that later on, she said that she was talking about something with her husband. And she said that oppression by a narcissistic control freak is something my husband has never experienced, with the kind of connotation being that she has experienced oppression by a narcissistic personality. And then you look back and you think that makes sense of all her grudges that were making me think, why are you so hooked up on the thank you? Or why are you so hooked up on a man who wants to look after you?
I kind of think her husband might be being oppressed by a narcissistic personality even as we speak.
Without knowing. Yeah.
I say that with love in my heart.
For Sophie Hannah. Yeah, so that's interesting. And that must be where... So that's why you would disagree, because Annabelle and I disagreed on Uncle Vern, because I felt that it was a completely unjust grudge, because I suppose I have never been oppressed by a narcissistic control freak. And in fact, possibly I might be the narcissistic control freak.
For listeners wondering what the Vern story is,
yes,
can you set it up for us?
Okay, so and jump in, you two, if I get anything wrong, okay, because I will be slightly biased in favour of Uncle Vern. So she was at home with her two children. The two children were 1 and 3. And her aunt's husband, sorry, so Vern is not her blood relation, had come to the house, and she says Vern was a slightly kind of obsessive person, and he worried about children because he'd had a difficult childhood himself. So it got to a situation where Vern and the aunt were about to leave, and they were about to order a taxi, and she said, when the taxi comes, I will come out with you and get something from my car. And Vern said, no, you go and get something from your car. We will wait. Then we will order the taxi, because I don't want the children being left in the house alone in case the door shuts and they're locked in. And she said that she could prove to him that the door couldn't lock because of the way the door was set up. And so she said to him, you go, you have to call your taxi now. You have to go. And I'm going to come out at the same time. So this happened. She walked out to her car and she looked over and Uncle Vern was sitting in his taxi, not leaving the driveway, obviously waiting for her to go back in the house. And so she got her stuff, she went back in the house, and she's held a grudge against Vern ever since for doing this. And to the point where she went out later and called Vern from outside her house so he knew.
She thought about doing it.
Oh, did she not do it?
I don't think she actually
did it. I don't think she actually did. She considered, just like, you know, you can't control my behavior, I'll show you.
Yeah, you cannot control me.
And I kind of feel like, to me, like, I grew up in the era where a date was not supposed to drive away from your house until you had gone in the front door because it was courteous to see that you were safe. And on one hand, I think that's a little bit overreacty. I mean, we don't live in that unsafe a culture unless we're all living in, you know, the South Side of Philadelphia or whatever. But I think, yes, he was a little pushy and controlling, and certainly I wasn't there in the situation. I don't know how Sophie felt at the time. But to me, that's more of a, oh, that's really sweet of you. Thanks for thinking you have to look after me. Isn't that cute?
Yes,
rather than an I hate you forever.
It might be an eye roll from me, like, oh, yeah. Vern, oh, you're fuss-spotting. But he actually left when she insisted he left. So he didn't make her go out on her own. He left the house. So he was in a situation he didn't want, where in his eyes, something could have happened and the
But she'd already told him that nothing could happen because the door could not shut because it was a special kind of door.
But he didn't stay and centrify. You know, he wasn't in the house.
Yeah,
he
that
left,
would have been even worse.
And he sat, yes. But that I can see why you would have a grudge, because that is saying to her, I don't trust you.
Exactly.
But he left the house as she'd requested.
So it's not that in this book she doesn't understand the practices of forgiving and forgetting. She's well versed in that kind of attitude towards holding grudges. She's tried to do it in the past, but she just hasn't found that that works for her. And there seem to be, I think, two different kinds of self-help books, if you will. So you have the ones that put forward these perfect ideals that you should aspire to. And I think that on the other hand, you have the ones that say, don't even try, do this instead, like the guilt-free attitude.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that we should feel guilty about holding grudges? Do you think that they should be encouraged? Like, how do you feel about this?
You know, I think one of the really good points that she makes in here, and I have a lot of challenges with this book, but I think one of the good points she makes is that forgiving does not mean forgetting. Not holding it in your heart every day to burn like acid does not mean you have to let somebody treat you poorly the next time around. And in that way, it almost reminded me of this really great book that I think a lot of women should read called The Gift of Fear by Gavin De Becker. And Gavin De Becker has written this entire book about how to protect yourself against stalkers and muggers and people who intrude into your life in a negative or violent way. And one of the things he points out is you do know, your intuition already knows, but you don't want to be rude. And so a lot of times women in particular open ourselves up to harm because we don't want to be rude. And in some ways, How to Hold a Grudge strikes me as a uniquely British book, because it is in the voice of someone who is really desperate not to give offense. And my best friend is British. My husband is British. I'm American, man. And when we want somebody to take a leap, we say, dude, I'm not going to do that thing. That sucks. Or you can't do that to me. That's not okay. And I mean, not to say that Americans are 100% terrific at not being passive aggressive, but we are a much less passive aggressive culture. And so much of this book is about holding a grudge instead of addressing things in the moment.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, actually. And it actually reminds me of something from, we were talking about Friends earlier, the show, and Ricky Gervais made a comment about how kind of in America, friendship is all about like full on love worn on your sleeve, all very obvious. Whereas in England, you're only sincere if you really have to in the situation, can't allow for anything else. And it's the same with that kind of anger or protest. You only show an extreme emotion like that if you're absolutely forced into it. Otherwise, you will try the passive-aggressive, overly polite route where you're hoping your message gets across. And yeah. It doesn't always.
It's like Americans are on one end where, you know, we just tell people to take a leap. And Japanese are on the extreme other end where, you know, when you mean heck no, no way, no how, you say, there may be some difficulty with that. And British people are sort of in the middle.
Fine. We say fine.
Fine. It'll be fine.
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah. I think this is really interesting because all my thoughts about this were, you know, conflicted about whether to take the easy route, which is holding on to the grudge, which I got the impression that it was kind of easier in certain circumstances to just to hold the grudge and not say anything, rather than trying really hard to let the grudge go, to not forget, but to forgive. But it's more about addressing it in the moment. And that's why these grudges persist, isn't it? Because
famous quote about how, those who don't, people who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it, that thing. So it is important to reflect, if somebody has wounded you before, that it will probably happen again. And it's worth being a little bit cautious in your dealings with them. But then equally, you suffer more than anyone else if you build up these deep wells of resentment. Nobody else really cares. It's you that struggles.
And she does recognize in here that you can't control anyone else's behavior. You can only control your reaction to it. But then I think she shies away from that in a way that would be more worthy of exploration. I mean, so for example, driving in Dubai is a very exciting sport. And my husband, who is British, gets very unhappy on the roads whenever anyone cuts him off or doesn't let him in or, won't let him pass or whatever. Whereas I kind of go out in the morning and I'm like, everybody here drives like a 12-year-old playing Mario Kart. So
let's
I don't have to drive unsafely. I can just expect, no one's going to let me in. That's not the rules here. No one is going to let me pass. That's not the rules here. You know, and people will be confused if I attempt to let them in, and I will have to wave vigorously in my car. Like, no, I'm letting you in, dude. Get in. But it doesn't make me mad. It doesn't feel like a personal affront because it's just the way it is.
Yeah.
And it strikes me that a lot of the people that Sophie Hannah is holding grudges against, it might be more pleasant, I guess, for her to step back and go, okay, Uncle Vern is kind of an overprotective jerk, and that's okay. Bless him. I hope he derives great pleasure from being an overprotective jerk, and I'm just going to ignore it and move on and do what I would normally do. Oh, hey, you know, this girl who slighted me at her wedding is just kind of a jerk, and that's okay. I can't control that. I can only control how much time I spend around her.
Also, I think there's a sort of swings and roundabouts elements to it, whereas the negative parts of a person's personality are probably connected to the positive parts. So Uncle Vern, nightmare stalker on the edge of your driveway that he may be, is probably very caring and will do anything he can to help. And those two things are connected. You can't have one without the other.
Yeah. I think, honestly, a lot of this book could have been said in a brief magazine
essay,
article.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, it feels a little bit like in tone, and I don't mean this as a negative, but it feels in tone like the kind of thing you would read in Glamour or Cosmopolitan, and really it should be about the length of a subway ride. It's a little bit challenging to wade through many, many examples of grudges of people who we don't know. Like, there's a couple of really interesting famous grudges in here. Joan Crawford and Betty Davis, who were, you know, famously rivals and just strategically horrible to each other all the time.
Hilariously horrible. So there was the story of how Betty Davis installed a Coke vending machine because Crawford's husband had been the Pepsi CEO. It's these little hilariously malevolent actions that are brilliant.
And the painter Stuart Semple and Anish Kapoor. So Anish Kapoor has this monopoly on a really specific kind of ultra black paint that was developed in a scientific lab. And Stuart Semple got so mad that Anish Kapoor wouldn't let anybody else use this paint or have access to it, that when you buy special paint through Stuart Semple's site, you have to tick a box that says, I promise I'm not going to get this paint to Anish Kapoor and I have no connection to him. And see, I think she might have been better served by looking at, okay, so here's the famous Crawford-Davis grudge.
Yes.
Here's the parallel in my life that I see to this, and here's what you might do when this comes up in your life.
That would have been a fascinating book.
Yeah, it's very interesting. That there are, like you say, she was really onto something, I think, when she was talking about when she was talking about forgiving and forgetting and how that method didn't work for her. She touched on the Eckhart Tolle method about the stories that we tell ourselves. So it's easier said than done for certain things. Because what was it that he was saying, that you can't control what people do to you, but you can control how you feel about it?
Yes, yeah. And you can reinvent your story of what happened, exactly, in order to have a healthier response to it.
But I agree with her about there's only, it's easier said than done for certain things.
That's true.
But also what she's doing, or suggesting that we do, is construct these grudges in a certain way that they are kind of more palatable to us, that they are, that we can put them away in a grudge cabinet. And in a way, that is also trying to manipulate our emotions in a way that perhaps isn't easy. So I think it's just a different kind of difficult.
I think recasting is maybe easier than manipulating. Like, one of the things I thought as I was reading this book is, you know, well, I'm an author and I have a nonfiction book published and a lot of essays and a radio show and stuff, but I don't have a novel published. And so consequently, I have a bit of a grudge against anybody who has ever successfully published a novel. But at the same time, that's an envy-driven grudge. And when you really break it down, envy is the feeling of, that should be mine. And we don't envy things we can never have. Like, I don't envy people with Lamborghinis. I'm never going to drive a Lamborghini. I don't envy people who are married to supermodels. I'm never going to marry a supermodel. You know, I'm pretty happy with the model that I have right now. But I do envy people who have a published novel because I'm close. And so in that respect, that envy is a good feeling. It's a positive feeling. It's a healthy feeling.
Because it drives you to succeed.
Yeah. Yes. And it's saying, you're almost there. Don't quit. It's okay to have this feeling of envy because you're almost there. And I think there's maybe a way to look at grudges more in that Gavin De Becker gift of fear way, where it's like, this person has shown me who they are. I need to believe that and protect myself accordingly, rather than I need to judge them and feel crappy about them.
Yes. I kind of like the analogy that she draws with commemorative memorials. So an event has happened and she's saying it's like trying to knock down all these memorials. You don't do that because there is a value to remembering, there is a value to kind of processing things. And she was saying it'd be like history lessons where you don't do the bad bits. And she said, life's not like that. And so you need to remember the bad bits, but work out how you can move on. And so there were elements that I found really interesting and compelling like that.
I like the word that you used as well, recasting. I think that's a much better way of thinking about it than manipulating, which I think is what I said.
Yeah. And I think that in this book, she goes through what is a grudge, and she goes through, these are grudges I have had and how I've reacted to them. I don't think she takes in this book that third step of, this is how to take it into your life.
Right.
Like, I think right now, this for me is not really working as a self-help book because it's all self and no help.
Okay. Yeah, fair
Nicely
enough.
Nicely summarized.
Yes. That is, you've articulated how I felt about it as well. Yeah. So would you recommend this to anyone?
You know, I really wouldn't. I would say instead, I would recommend The Gift of Fear by Gavin De Becker, and I would recommend some of Judith Lasseter, Lasseter, Judith Lasseter's work on yoga, where she talks about the philosophy of yoga and presuming that other people mean well and how to let go of stuff that's bothering you. I think that it's worth it to consider the value of recognizing how people are and making sure that you protect yourself accordingly. And there's value in allowing yourself to let go of feelings of anger or hurt that aren't serving you. But I don't think this book quite gets there.
I think I would recommend somebody in a group of friends having it, and you having it there like on a coffee table so you can dip in and discuss it and disagree with parts, and because it does lead to interesting conversations. I took a few photos of pages and sent them to people, either being critical and going, can you believe this doesn't make any sense? Or, oh, this is quite insightful. You know, I hadn't really thought about it that way. So in that sense, I'd recommend it. But not as a, this is a fantastic whole thing. There are bits in it that are very interesting.
I think it is a great discussion starter. I would recommend it as a kind of out and left field book club choice, actually.
Yes.
To sit around and discuss. If it's a club that you're close with, you know, if there's
well, that was friends. That's the other thing about it, because I was slightly nervous about this discussion because I was thinking you might get pulled into sharing stories of your life that you don't necessarily want to be on the radio.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.